My case study today really is a re-examination of work that I did collaboratively with computer scientists back in 2006. And it's looking at a case study on the Honan Chapel in University College Cork, and I deliberately chose that really as a tribute to Julianne, and thank you to Julianne and Anne for inviting me here. And when we were discussing it together, Julianne and myself, we focused on an area that we are particularly interested in from our former life at Cork, which is the scholarship of teaching and learning. And I think the scholarship of teaching and learning is particularly useful within this context because it has traditionally, because it's a field of educational studies, it has engaged with narrative inquiry. However, in what is emerging from the conversations this morning, I sense that there is a kind of an either-or situation in that the historical sciences, you know, are a little bit problematic with critical theory. They find it a little bit troublesome. And just as before I kind of start the talk, 2 weeks ago I gave a presentation at Imperial College as part of the Royal Geographical Society's annual conference. And the discussant in our section, Professor Charles Withers, pointed out to the need to look at the text as not a fixed entity in its historical life, but that it has other lives, it's got other histories that have either been accepted or discarded. So it's interesting to see that in historical sciences and in geography, there's this interest as well in many of the common themes that we're discussing this morning. So I think in that sense, it's kind of part of a common experience at the moment. I think that's important to keep in mind. Also, I want to critique the notion, what I've done is enfolded this case study within the area of theory. So I've chosen as a hidden history the absence of two craftsmen involved in the creation of this, the Honan Chapel, which was built in 1916. Then I want to survey within this enfolding and the survey of narrative inquiry as a method for historical studies and some of the problems that are associated with that. And finally, then, I want to deconstruct the historical narrative of the Honan and ask, what can we learn from the hidden history? What can we learn from the absences? Because I think that is really interesting as well. So this is the Honan Chapel today in University College Cork. Our campus is not like your campus, which is neoclassical. Ours is a neo-Gothic. It dates from the 1840s. It was part of the Queen's Colleges established by Queen Victoria in the 1840s. And then in the 1890s, in Ireland, there was this interest in the arts and crafts movement, as there was in Britain, Europe, and also America. And the campus today is very, very different to what it looked like in 1916. In 1916, this is what it looked like, and this was deliberate. What you're looking at there is you're looking at glass houses, botanical houses, and you're also looking at what was then, it's now gone, a red brick building, which was the Honan Biological Institute. And this shielded the Honan Chapel, and that was deliberate. And the reason was because the university was a non-denominational institution. And that was very important because if you were Catholic or if you were dissenter and you were Irish in the mid-19th century, you didn't necessarily want to go to Oxford and Cambridge because of faith reasons. So there was this demand to have a university for Catholic and non-denominational students. And so there was a line physically, spatially drawn between the university and the chapel. With this new spatial alignment, you now think that it's actually a collegial chapel, and it actually isn't. However, a guidebook, which I'm looking at from 1916, mentions this chapel as a collegiate chapel. So I think that's quite interesting. Early on, it's writing this kind of history. Now, this is just part of a website that we created as part of the 90th anniversary back in 2006 with computer scientists. And this is a detail from the floor mosaic. And the official history that was written back in 2004 by the archivist of the college, Virginia Tian, and Libby Heckett, had gone into great detail, spent an awful lot of money through Cork University Press in producing these beautiful photographs, and had named Oppenheimer, the company, as the mosaicists. and that was well established. However, and I think this is a theme that kind of resonates, Melissa Therese has mentioned in her book, superb book on digital images and the informational professional, about the museum and the gallery as a memory institution. And in many senses, that's the problem with the official history of the chapel. Virginia T. and Libby Hebbett froze it in time, and they didn't see it as part of a living faith community. So they only took the story up to the end of the arts and crafts movement. They didn't talk about the remodeling of the chapel, and they didn't really probe the hidden narrative of why was there so little known about the Oppenheimers. But in 2006, as part of this project, the college curator Michael Holland began to get really excited in the Oppenheimer story. And in addition to that, there was a social movement going on. This is Cove Cathedral. It's St. Coleman's Cove. Cove, as you know, was formerly called Queenstown. If you don't know it, you'll know it through history because it was the last port of call of the Titanic in 1912. This is where people disembarked to go to the States. Now, this chapel began in the 1860s, finished in 1916, very much with the money from American immigrants. Has a fine collection of Oppenheimer mosaics. However, the priests in 2006 wanted to remodel this and get rid of the Oppenheimer mosaics. And so there was a whole social group that was created. And they mediated this conversation on ArchiSeq, which was an Irish architectural archive. Now, what I've done is in your presentation packs, you've got a full bibliography in terms of the theory, but I've also given you the threads from ArchiSeq dating from 2006, so you can see the type of conversation that was going on. And essentially what was going on was, we need to stop this, but we need to find more information on the Oppenheimers. Can anybody help? So that began the search that the curator, Mike Holland, was engaged in. But interesting enough, at the same time that that was going on, there was a gentleman in England who was doing work on the Oppenheimers, and through an oral testimony, because so much of the Oppenheimer archive was lost. They were mosaicists working in Manchester between 1865 and 1965, but much of their later history had to be kind of reclaimed through oral testimony. And Field was working on this, and the triangulation of the online information, what the curator discovered and what Field discovered, created a picture of who these artists were. And I'll just briefly tell you before then we look in at the theory. This is Lehman James Oppenheimer. He's in this picture probably 46. He was 48 when he died. He died at the end of the Battle of the Somme. He actually died on Vimy Ridge, which in 1917 was one of the assaults of the Canadian forces. It was a very important sector in 1917. He was an extremely fit man, and that's why, although he was in late middle age, he was allowed to join the British Army. Interesting enough, he joins a London regiment of the Territorial Army. It's the Artists' Rifles. And we know of such famous members of that regiment as Wilfred Owen. Now, his son is called Eric Newton. And you might ask, why is he Newton and not Oppenheimer? The reason is because after 1918, the name Oppenheimer had a German connotation, and he changed his name because of that. And his father was extremely patriotic and joined the army, I think really to compensate for this sense of being an outsider. What seems now to be clear is that father and son worked in 1913 on the Holen and Commission design, so we can actually identify them. And the online records, the regimental archives that we've discovered, this, for example, is from the Commonwealth War Commission, and we know that he's buried in Boulogne in the Eastern Cemetery there, Boulogne-sur-Mer. And online also are the documents from the Artists' Rifles, and we can see that he dies in France on the 8th of November 1916. And this is his son, Eric Newton, who goes on, becomes an important writer here in London. He marries his wife, Stella Mary Pierce, is a fashion historian in the Courtauld Institute, and dies in 2001. And there are members of the family that are still alive and involved in the arts in Canada. So all of this has opened up subsequent to that triangulation and conversation, which really draws on what Melissa was speaking about earlier. This is what Robert Field says, and I think it's quite interesting. I first knew of Eric Newton in the late 1960s by way of the numerous books he had written on art, many of them published as Pelicans, but only became aware of him as a mosaic artist in 2002 when I received a letter from Marion Dickinson, a parishioner of the Church of St. John the Baptist in Rochdale, who was trying to find out about the mosaics in the church and how they were made. Since then, I have been in contact with Eric Newton's granddaughter, who now lives in Canada, and others who are interested in Oppenheimer and the work they produced. So here you see that embedded within the narrative, Field has the oral testimony, the stories. The story is part of the narrative. Now, one of the problems, I think, in historical analysis, why it's an either-or, either document and the archive or critical theory, is because, as Arthur Marvick, the late Arthur Marvick, has said in a new Nature of History, published in 2001, that critical theorists foreshadow or heighten the critical theory, whereby, for historians, the theory is embedded within the method. So it's hidden. The method is hidden. However, I think we need to get the method right and understand the method before we can, you know, really use it, tease it, and play with it. Now, what I've done here in your handout is really just give you kind of a running survey of the current literature on narrative inquiry as a technique. But I just want to kind of highlight some of the genesis of the points. First of all, I think it really begins in the 1960s with critical theory anyway. And we think of people like Roland Barthes, The Death of the Author, where he says that the birth of the reader must be at the cost of the death of the author. What he's essentially saying there is that the narrative is fixed and bounded, and we need to create spaces whereby the reader can actually get involved in the process of creation as well, this co-creation of knowledge. Now, this is nothing new. If you read, for example, Walter Benjamin's work, Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, although he talks about the aura of the object, embedded there is that idea of the co-creation of knowledge. Alan Toffler in 1980 is saying this in the notion of the prosumer, and recently Mike Neary is talking about the idea of student as producer, and again he's drawing on the work of Walter Benjamin. So the point is, these writers are still, their ghosts are still very much with us, even though we might abhor critical theory in some respects, their ghost still hangs in the air. Mark Ferrow, a very interesting writer, I think, in The Use and Abuse of History, says, the teaching of history in the wake of postmodernity involves an acquisition of a better methodology of comprehension through the questioning of canonical narratives. We need to understand the chronologies, but importantly, we need to create new generative topics. New questions need to emerge through this complexity. So that really is the title of my paper, New Stories, or Different Stories to be Lived and Told, which comes from Kruber-Lobotsky and Hamilton's work in 2010. Both are educationists, but they say narrative inquirers, let's try to drain the swamp of experience through a systematic analysis of particular aspects of situations than to try to make its muddiness, if anything, even more generative in the sense of opening up possibilities for it to be otherwise, for different stories to be lived and told. Embedded within that, and this is very much from the kind of teaching and learning scenario, is the work of John Dewey. Dewey, as you know, worked as a philosopher in Chicago, and his work has very much influenced educationists ever since. And Dewey, as you're aware, sees the story and the narrative as linked within experience. And it is embedded within culture. And that is an important change that allows you to interrogate and to ask questions about a narrative that is embedded within its culture. Narrative inquiry, therefore, begins in the midst of an ongoing experience. It's an ongoing conversation. Narrative inquiries frame a research question that carries with it a sense of a search, a research, a searching again, a sense of continual reformation and reformulation of an argument. So it's this idea of, you know, asking better questions, acknowledging the muddiness, acknowledging the troublesomeness of the topic, but asking better questions. The knowledge developed from narrative inquiries is tested by incompleteness and particularity. Claudinen and Huber, whose work in 2010 really is a wonderful summary. I've put the online link to their in-press citation because you'll find it online, and it is fantastic. It gives a wonderful overview of the current state of narrative inquiry as a method. They argue that the signature and voice shape the research texts. It's important that the voice of the inquirer does not write over the voices of participants in the final research text. Now, I think this is important because what it hints at is the role of ethics or responsibility. That if you're a researcher involved in this, the question that you need to ask is, you know, how much of my voice needs to intrude on other people's voices? And also, you need to be sensitive to that because hopefully you will be revisiting the stories at a later date. If we keep in mind that the story is never complete, it's always part of a process, then you need to revisit it. Also, you need to be aware that stories are personal to people, that they are their story, their sense of the world. And this, I think, is where Dewey is really important. Dewey gives us a key to this, because if you read his work, you will see that he links education with experience. It is your perception of the world that in many ways conditions the way in, and your attitudes to the world. And therefore, to work with a story, you need to acknowledge the story as personal to the individual concerned. In terms of educational research, you see it in the field of what is called critical pedagogy. And there's a huge amount of literature out there. And critical pedagogy is very useful because it links to that question of working with story. So regarding audience, narrative inquiries need to be attentive to the features of the discourse communities where research texts are shared, so that the lives represented are respected. In other words, you have to be aware of who are your audiences. And, you know, you may need to frame your discourse and your analysis to work and blend in to your audience perception. But at the same time, you also need to handle the narrative so that the narrative is itself an authentic thing. The reason I suppose I speak so passionately about this is because a lot of my work in terms of teaching and learning is working with graduate teachers. And there we work on learning portfolios. And there what they do is they collect and document data from their courses and as a way of representing a snapshot in time. And that idea of a snapshot in time is something as well, because narrative and story is always becoming. It is always in a state of being. It is always being renewed. And therefore, whatever you create has to always be bounded and framed by the idea that this is only a snapshot in history and time.